Blog Talk Radio.
I'm on the mic. I'm on the mic. I'm on the mic. I got.
I want to thank everybody for listening to that song. It's called Running Late, and it's by China McLeod. He's one of the most awesome people I know, and I just want to thank him for that song. My name's Debbie Perkins, and this is the Hollywood Red Carpet Radio Show. I am here with an amazing actor. He has 160-plus and moving forward movie titles. He's been a producer, a super amazing actor. You'd recognize him if you saw him, Robert Lissardo. Welcome to the show, Robert. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me, Deb.
This is incredible. I mean, I have seen you in, I can't even tell you how many films. And when I booked you, I kind of remembered back, like, as I was going through your bio. And I was so impressed and so pleased because you're so wide range. But because you're such an amazing person and an awesome actor, how did you get started? Like, was you a young kid and you wanted to be an actor? Was this something that you wanted to do as a young person?
I had no preconceived notions about it. It was more or less happenstance. You know, I was in junior high school and I had a drama teacher, actually an English teacher, who taught drama as an elective, and she recommended that I go to her class as a way to kind of deal with the restlessness that she observed in the classroom with me. I couldn't really focus. I don't know if I could ever focus in school. Maybe I have a lot of company in that regard. But the
you
point
do.
Is that
you do. And you know what? They turn into geniuses, Robert. So.
Well, you're sweet. So anyway, long story short, I took her class and I had a lot of fun performing plays, and I noticed the reaction that my classmates observing me, and it was kind of bizarre to see it, to witness it. And then she recommended, the teacher did, that I auditioned for the High School for Performing Arts in New York City.
Wow.
And what they were, yeah, and so when we broke it down, the realization was that, you know, every year they would audition, you know, like 2,000 applicants, and they'd accept 70. So I was a little intimidated by those numbers and the whole idea of auditioning. But she encouraged me that if I worked hard, that, you know, she would, you know, assist me in coaching the, you know, the monologues and performing them and getting comfortable with, you know, the you know, the testing.
Yeah.
And so we, you know, we went through this vigorous training and you know, worked on these two contemporary monologues. They require that you prepare those. And then I think in addition to the two monologues, you would have to do a cold reading with one of the
how old are you at this point?
School members.
When you're how old are you?
I would say, let's see, junior high school, maybe, I don't know, teenager, 14 or 15.
Okay, so pretty influential, but still got your own, you still have your own mind at that point.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of identity, I guess.
You're
yeah,
a teenage boy.
Yeah.
So how did
yeah,
you reframe
and, you know, and you know how they
girls?
Are, right?
Well, yes,
yeah.
Because.
Pretty much, yeah. There was, yeah, absolutely. The
you
hormones
either dig into
and,
sports or you dig into girls, but there's always teenage boys can be in any direction. You never know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, sometimes they go down directions that are not always, useful
which
to
is,
them. You know?
Yeah. Which is awesome that you didn't, you know what? And a lot of people do. And that, trial and error. Well, you know, we all make mistakes. But then again, if people didn't make so many mistakes, then there wouldn't be any need for drama. There wouldn't be any need for movies. You know what I'm saying? Like, it all kind of works itself out together. And you've been in some real serious filming that could challenge the most average person.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I think catharsis is the ingredient for the cosmic spectacle theater that we call reality or life, whatever it is. I think what you said makes a lot of sense. If it's used for inspiration and insight, it can be helpful, especially when it's placed on a stage and, you know, there's no karmic repercussions other than the audience being affected by something and being able to learn or simply be entertained.
That's very true. You grew up in New York.
That's correct. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And now, but you're on the West Coast. So that's a big difference between the two states in general.
Opportunities
absolutely. Either direction, though, for an actor.
Well, I think the I think the mindset too. Maybe I don't know. In the beginning, it just seemed like another planet. You know, now it doesn't, but because I've lived in California for so long, New York seems like another planet to me now. But a lot of it has to do with relationship dynamics and being attached to people in various timelines. You know, as time goes on, though, everything you know and are attached to, you know, either changes or disappears. It's just the nature of things. And as I learned to detach so that I could fulfill the destiny that I saw in front of me, it was a very painful process, but necessary. But then I was able to transition to the West Coast in relationship to opportunities that were offered to me.
Now, what year did you end up moving out to the California direction?
Let's see. I was offered a contract with Warner Brothers in 1987.
Wow.
To go out for 3 months on a studio picture. So, yeah, that was my first introduction to California.
That's amazing.
And,
professionally, you must have been on top of the world. You were traveling across the United States to go film something.
Yeah.
That's
Deb. It was exciting as hell. Yeah, it was also surreal. Yeah, it was pretty.
We must have been so nervous, on the plane going over, going, is this really happening? You know what I mean? Just wonder, is this really,
well, I
really
don't,
happening?
I don't specifically remember that. What I do remember is sitting in a conference room at a round table to do the table read for the project and seeing, celebrities walk through the door. And that
was my gosh.
Intimidating and quite frightening.
Was it?
And so,
was it?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh! You swallow your tongue a couple times. But how do you avoid from saying silly things? Because you know how when you're nervous, your mouth doesn't keep up with your brain sometimes, and then it says something stupid. Like I was going, how am I going to get through this interview with Robert and not say something stupid? Because I think when we get nervous, because to me you're a big star, what you consider a big star, I might consider a big star as well, but I think you're right there with them, if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, I'll speak to that in a moment. I appreciate the compliment, but I'll speak to my take on that perception in a second. But I will say that, I can relate. We've all been there. We've all put our foot in our mouth. We've all, stumbled through circumstances when we've been enamored by a person or a situation. You know, Lord knows, we've all been there, so I think, no shame, no regret. It's just being human and, the frailty of humanness. It's, I think that's to be expected. It's cool. And I think, when you're around people that understand that in themselves as well, then there's no, there's no judgment. It's just, you giggle about it and you move on. It's not a problem.
Absolutely. Because it's life.
Yeah.
It really is. You've done some really amazing films. What was the first film that you did that you feel is sort of stuck with you throughout the years? Or, I mean, it could be recent, but what film have you done that you did that has kind of stayed with you throughout the years? Or maybe there isn't one.
Well, you know, you get attached for different reasons, or things leave their mark for other reasons. I think the sentimental aspect of it was that my opportunity to work with Richard Pryor, and I've talked about this, you know, it seems redundant at this point, but I don't know if it really is, because it's a very real and personal happening for me, meaning that it set the course for me, or it set the pace in which I was able to navigate the course with commitment, with a sense of purpose. Because prior to that, even when I got the job, and I was flying out to California under contract, every possible variable that would point to success, and all the things that people dream of, and then this lottery ticket, you pick it, you win. I still, within myself, had doubts, because I had been trained to doubt by people around me, the way I grew up, which is another story. But the point is that to transcend that thinking, that mindset, is not an easy task. And so I think my first big break, which was the movie I just described, The Contract with the Warner Brothers, was significant, not necessarily because it was a studio movie or because I got to work with this idea of big movie stars at the time. It was because I was fortunate enough to work opposite Richard Pryor, and him being the kind of man he was, so endearing and honest with me, told me things I needed to hear that made it possible for me to recognize what I potentially was capable of. And sometimes, even if you can achieve the goal, so to speak, if you don't believe that you deserve to be there, you don't know how to stand in that place effectively. And sometimes people sabotage their platform, their station in life, because they don't know how to function within it comfortably, because of issues from the past, certain self-esteem issues, or how they imagine themselves to be. So I think it was crucial for me personally to have that experience, times the professional, validation that occurred with being in a movie like that, a studio picture seen by all these people, working with, like you say, these movie stars and all this stuff. But I think, like I said, what I took away from it was this sort of kind of personal, endearing friendship that I was was created within that small span of time, that made all the difference in how I saw myself in relationship to this idea of a career.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And so, to speak to your point about looking, you look up at something, you see God. You look down, you see a fool. You look straight ahead, you see yourself. So to me, this idea of levels, or big stars, little stars, whatever, this kind of measurement where you weigh people in the balance and what they're worth, kind of thing. Maybe in the beginning, there may be a temptation to view things that way, but once you move through the experiences and realize that who you're standing opposite are just simply people that have an extraordinary ability. Some do, some don't. And if they're nice, great. Sometimes they're not so nice. And maybe one of the worst things that can happen is you meet someone that you've been, that you've idolized, and they don't necessarily live up to what you projected onto them. So there's a danger in creating that idol, of building it, to set yourself up for disappointment. And I don't know how fair it is to the artist or the movie star or performer, or however you see them or her, to lay that kind of trip. Because, they're just people, man, trying to get through it, and maybe they're having a bad day. So I've learned over time to kind of try to move past that aspect of things and just see the person. And,
that's really cool.
And that's all there really is, aside from the apparatus itself, the mechanism of media, the magic show of movie making and all that stuff lend qualities to the human being that make it seem supernatural. That's why people love movies, and to escape into them, because they can go into this kind of like alternate universe, and worship things or become enamored by them or lose themselves in the fantasy, The difficulty sometimes being able to discern between the two. You know, that's where it gets confusing and people,
I think,
idolatry comes into play and you have to be careful with that. At least I do.
Yeah. So, I think I understand what you're saying. I love that. What a great story. You could write a book. You probably have all kinds of little stories. So many people, I think they are interested because of this, coronavirus going down here now, I think people are more attracted to being home, or they're stuck at home. You know what I mean? And there's all the movies, all the old movies that nobody knew about or kind of passed us by. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They're now coming out and everybody's going, what? I think I even said it the other day, like, I didn't realize that this particular actor was in this particular film. And I went, wow, that's crazy. How did I not know that? You know? So I think we're getting back what we may have, because when the world was moving faster, movies came and went and you didn't get to see them. Or if you did, it was so quick. You know what I mean? Like, they just, mostly everybody would focus on the TV. Well, now everybody's focusing on the movies. You know, it's a different, like you said, you're going into another world. And looking at your bio, you've portrayed so many different actors, different types of people. What was your favorite act? Which was your favorite? Not so much scene, but character. Who was your favorite character?
Right. Yeah, I'm not really impressed with the trends. That's why I don't watch television, and I don't really care about, what the general consensus is regarding, what the it thing is, the person, the film, whatever. But and I say that in relationship to, my own phenomenon, whatever timelines in my career that mark, this idea of apex success. This is where he was at his best, and this is some of his best work and all of that. I mean, I appreciate it, and I'm grateful that there are, fans and viewers that are attached to certain, character types and archetypes, and they're like, wow, I love this character. And so, I'm grateful that I receive accolades to this day on things I've forgotten about, because I don't, wake up every day and focus
right.
on those things. I mean, you know what I mean? I've kind of forgotten
about
it.
Other things going on, yes.
Yeah.
Always,
but the point is that my own personal to inhabit character space that challenged me. And as you grow as an artist, if you truly embrace the craft, you want to be presented with those opportunities. And so most recently I worked on a film called Bloodthirst, produced by Michael Mahal and Sonny Mahal, directed by Michael Hsu, where I play this character, the vampire master. And it was just a lot of fun.
That's
for
cool.
me, and extremely challenging to inhabit the space of a vampire and have them, the makeup put on, the teeth, the cape. It was just, the costume lends itself to a disposition that you normally don't carry in your day-to-day doings, So it was wonderful to be possessed by the spirit of Nosferatu.
That's so cool. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And when you get into character, how do you get yourself? Is it like from other people that you know, or is your character created in your own mind?
Well, it's a combination of things. First off, it's the writing itself, the script. You read the script, right?
Yeah.
And you allow your imagination to process the story, and you utilize that apparatus to find that world. We all have imagination. Some of us use it quite often. Some of us have let it become stagnant. It's my job to continue to keep that muscle pretty strong. So I'm always kind of making movies in my head, so to speak, the way I look at the world. It's always through a lens, more or less. So when I read a script and I see the character on the page, I actually start to see the character lift up off the page, and I envision the story in three-dimensional form after I read it several times. And then from there, you start working out the mechanics of dialogue and the disposition of character, the state of being that the character has, the intention, what the character wants, where the character exists, what that's like, how it affects, you as the character, where you're going, what the goal is. All these, questions have to be kind of worked through And then that combined with the dialogue with the director and, you know, sharing, you know, ideas about how to move forward into that space is also key. You want to also have someone that, that understands your point of view in relationship to the material, who's in charge of the show and has a relationship with the cameraman so that everything integrates properly, your performance, the frame they build around you, the way it's photographed, et cetera, you know? So in this case, Bloodthirst, I felt it was a very fortuitous kind of circumstance for me because Michael Sue understood exactly where I was coming from, the director. This is the director, and he's also the cameraman. And I felt we had a great relationship in terms of that building of this world together, and also the art department, all the other aspects of movie making that build this world and make, you know, the two-dimensional page become a three-dimensional space to literally inhabit, also lends itself to the characterization and the other actors and their ability to authenticate their characters as well, is this kind of collective hypnosis that ideally embraces everyone. And, you know, that's, I think, if you're open to that and allow yourself to feel the vibration of that play and not be distracted, you know, by other things that could, you know, break focus, then you can inhabit that world very realistically in relationship to what the material suggests. It's up to you. It's about focus and discipline and your ability to use your imagination to dig a really, really, really deep well.
Yeah. I think that's great advice for, especially for some people that may be listening that are interested in the field of acting, because, you know, they believe it's all glitz and glam, and they don't realize there's way more under the surface.
Well, for people who are, you know, enamored by media and fame, then there's glitz and glam. For people who are just artists and love the work itself, it's, you know, apples and oranges. I don't know if one necessarily constitutes the other. There's been a, you know, this assumed marriage, but I don't know how accurate that is in relationship to the work itself. The work is still required. You still have to be able to deliver and, you know, do what's, you know, what's asked of you. Either you know how to play, I use this, you know, this analogy a lot, either know how to play the piano or you don't. You can pretend and they can put a track over that and make it look like you play the piano. Look how well she plays the piano. She looks so good doing it, but she's not really doing it, you know. It's
right.
The same thing. So there are movies that are constructed around egos and personality types, cult types and visual aesthetic, you know, very pretty looking people that give the illusion of something. And there's people that love that sort of thing. And there's other audience members that require a little bit more, you know, maybe that's where the work comes in. Maybe that's where it's not about what you look like. It's about how you can conjure a disposition of character that's effective and realistic. And that's very hard to do. It requires incredible energy and tremendous focus. It's extremely tedious and requires repetition and an ability to lose oneself from the work completely and be, you know, committed not to your reflection in the mirror, but what the character requires and what the work requires, what the playwright requires, screenplay writer, what the director requires. What, you know, that's how you discern between, you know, the capable ones and the hacks, you know.
Right. And you make a good point. You make a lot of good points, actually. A lot of people don't understand what it does entail. And you pretty much put it right out there as honestly as you can. And I really do think that it is great to know, because anybody who wants to get into the field of acting, you have to put your all in or it's just going to be a bust. You're wasting people's time, you know. I love the way you put things because you just, I recently saw for the second time, I actually watched it before, but I watched you in The Mule with Clint Eastwood, and he's like somebody I grew up, you know, he's a funny man, he's a gentleman, he was a great guy that I always admired him as an actor, but also as a human being, because he was a great person. How is it when you were doing the film with him? Because he's a much older gentleman, and I was like, he's so, I mean, I love Clint Eastwood, don't get me wrong, he's a great guy, but he's an older man, and he was in that film with you, and I don't know how he did that. It just amazes me.
Right. Well, despite his age and what that may suggest, he's quite capable. And, you know, if you've seen the film, I mean, depending on your take on that movie, I mean, it's obvious that he still knows very clearly what he's doing. In my experience with him standing face to face, that was obvious. And so did his crew. I've never seen a crew function so efficiently and without words, very quietly, as if they had done many movies. You know, apparently he uses the same people, works with the same people over and over again. They're a family, I guess, more or less. And so to watch the apparatus function so perfectly like that, and Clint Eastwood to inhabit the space where he was working so unassuming was a pleasure. At first, you know, it was intimidating because it's Clint Eastwood you're standing opposite of. So I think we're all a little bit nervous the first day because, you know, I had no frame of reference. I didn't know what to expect with him.
Right.
You know, and haven't had the best experiences with, you know, with the exception of, you know, obviously Richard Pryor was an anomaly. That was a beautiful experience, but not everybody functions that way.
Right.
And deals with the fame so with humility like that, like Richard did. So I wasn't sure what it would be like, but, you know, I'd like, you know, for me, once again, it was another blessing because he was very giving, very fluid in his ability to move with me in the scene without too many restrictions. He kind of plays jazz in the way he allows the scenes to breathe and function. There may be something written on the page in terms of structure with a beginning, middle, and an end, but he lets you play within there if you're capable to ad-lib, I mean, and improvise. And he used some of that stuff that we played around with in our sequences together, him and I. And it didn't end up on the cutting room floor. He actually utilized it. And I thought, wow.
That's so cool.
And, yeah, and he was, like I said, he was just very friendly. He didn't say much, kind of quiet. Tell, one eye was looking at me in the scene, you know, as the actor that he was portraying, Earl, and another eye was observing as the director, the mechanism. So his ability to do that simultaneously was very impressive to watch. I knew he was doing it. I could see him doing it. But it didn't get in the way of his ability to incarnate, to manifest that character correctly. So it was a great experience. And then I think after we did a take, he kind of tapped me in the stomach and said, "Good stuff, kid." Thank you. And then I remember when we broke for lunch, just to give you an idea of his character, we broke for lunch and I saw this man standing at the back of the line with his head down in this kind of unassuming posture. But, you know, and I realized it was Clint Eastwood. You know, so who's this older guy waiting at the back of the line to eat his lunch? And it was him, you know. So he let everyone go ahead of him. And also a new one for me because most of the celebrities I've witnessed, you know, who have any kind of stature like that, they are usually, you know, kind of hustled away to their trailer, don't want to talk to anybody, you know. And he made himself completely available and sat down with the crew and ate his lunch. And
you know,
really,
that's wonderful because he taken in every memory he can while he is here. And, you know, you got to give him that. Like, because for one, I think probably even when you guys were breaking, some of the most funny entertainment stories come out, you know, just you guys just hanging out, just talking, you know, is entertainment, you know, to men. And he's a man's man, it seems like. Just like you are. I think a man's man, that's like my grandfather. He was a man's man.
Yeah.
He liked to be around men. And it's almost like the men would go do their thing and then the women did their own thing and then they'd get back together. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, completely.
That's what it seemed like. You guys are both like, you're both men's men. So that makes a lot of sense that he would want to hang out with the men. Men are supposed to bond like that anyway. I think it's tribal or it's something, but I do know that, you know, wherever there's one man, another man wants to hang around. What's going on? You know, but it's pretty amazing. I'm so happy to hear that story about him with you because it does teach people to be a little bit more humble in this world. Because great things do come your way. Because that really was an amazing opportunity for you to play in that film, because it was well written and it was really, you know, it was well put together, and it makes, you know, it's like it's almost like it could really have happened. And that's what I love about the films that you've been in. Now, I didn't realize you were in Waterworld. I bet I've seen that 100 times. There's some movies I've just seen over and over and over. But now, you don't, do you watch yourself on film when after a movie comes out? Do you, and do you, are you your own worst critic?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that I'm very particular these days in what I watch. If there's an opportunity for character development, when I'm afforded that right, actually not right, I'm afforded that luxury, I'd say, that's the better word. I'm curious to see how it comes out, because I want the work to be at least adequate, so I can learn how to continue to be effective and grow. If it's something, they build a frame around me that doesn't allow much growth or room, then generally I don't participate as an audience member in those things, because there's not much there to look at. Even if what I'm doing is realistic, still I don't find it useful. So I think most recently I have observed movies that have come out that where the directors and the writers have given me quite a bit more to do in terms of, like I said, character development, the range, the emotional disposition, the vulnerability, some of the insight that the character has, in regarding the writing. So in instances like that, yeah, I'll observe it. You know, I just did a movie called Hope for the Holidays, which is a Christmas type film that's based on a story. It's a story of reclamation, and deals with spiritual and faith based themes. And that was something I was curious to see, because it's a sympathetic character that I portray, unlike some of the other stuff that I've been presented with. This was an opportunity to show a more vulnerable side. And
that's,
I like,
awesome.
That, because I'm not often,
I
allowed
like
to
that.
Do that. Yeah.
Because Robert,
have you seen
played
the film?
A lot of tough guy. No, I haven't yet, but I've but I've seen you in playing a lot of tough guys. You're like, well, one of the guys that put the video up for us for you, you were the first person he called it, was an American badass, he said. And I think he's right, because you did play a lot of parts where you had to play a bad, you know, not, well, a bad guy, but not a bad guy, you know what I mean? It was like, you weren't really a bad guy, you just, is that, just a tough guy. You're just a tough guy.
Right. Let me see if I can help you with this. I don't like to label the characters. I think that what I do is try to build something that is respectful to the art form itself, and then also be as realistic with what they give me as humanly possible, because they don't always give me a lot. And sometimes what they give me lives in the realm of cliche and stereotypical world. And so I'm required, well, I'm not required. I've been taught by teachers to, create real characters, you know, or inhabit the space in a very realistic way. So I think that when you look at the material and you see how they perceive you, and you look at the scripts and you see it over and over again, there's a couple of things that happen. At least it happened to me. You can become very resentful, and you can recognize also that they're exploiting certain aspects of maybe tendencies you have, or what they observe you to be based on a preconceived notion, because they've been since childhood they've watched films and don't really understand the nature of the subject that they're writing about. They project qualities onto it based on fallacy, based on misperception or prejudices and things like that. So when you see that the writing holds a lot of the taboo and people without insight, then you have to move past that and try to find a way to offer qualities to the character that they don't even understand or can't conceive of, that are human, you know. And then you just simply have the best way to describe it would be that you have an outlaw present. You have someone who stands out on the periphery, the pariah, so to speak, the social misfit, the individual that does not play by the rules, that resists the conventional mindset within the typical story, as you know. And so in that sense, I think some of the characters I've been asked to portray are tortured. They're conflicted. They battle with this idea of good and evil within themselves, like a lot of people deal with temptations within themselves and their psyche that make for a very confusing existence. And that's how I see these characters. I don't see them as bad guys. I simply or badass. I see them as men who struggle with a conflict and are placed in certain types of circumstances and have to either survive those circumstances, persevere, transcend, or be destroyed by them. And in that sense, it's a very real exploration and journey rather than the labels that have been placed on these characters that take away their humanness. Does that communicate?
That's incredible. I like the way you think. It's not black and white. It's kind of
well, there
all
is black
over.
And white. Well, I mean, what is, I mean, come on, let's be realistic. Black and white.
That's
what
true.
Is, I mean, black and white's a... Black and white's a TV commercial, man. I mean, let's face it. What is black? There's no black and white. Black and white's an illusion. There's no such thing. Black and white's an invention. You know what I mean? I mean, maybe it lives in a 1950s movie or something. But if you
yeah.
wake up to the 21st century and walk around, good luck trying to put things into categories like that now. With, you know, people exploring, you know, various aspects of their being through sexual identity, through, you know, any number of things, you know, that are not... that kind of break away from the traditional paradigm, you know? So what's black and white? I mean, there's basically this fundamental morality that say that, well, you can't hurt someone. As long as you're not hurting anyone or you're not messing with children, two or more adults inhabit a space and they abide by the laws governed by the kingdom, by the country, whatever the entity is that runs the show. Then as long as you abide by the law set out by that constitution and agreement, you're good to go. Then everything else is subjective in terms of morality, right? So, I mean, especially these days, more than ever before. So I don't know if black and white makes any kind of sense.
Well, that's not you, that's for sure. You're awesome.
Well,
you're
I think
so
people
incredible.
Limit themselves in the way they perceive things by putting things into
that
categories.
That is true. I think, and I might,
when you
and
put
I'm
things
guilty
into cat-
of that, too.
When you put things into categories, then it's easy to label people. And then this is where we get into trouble. You know, there's all this labeling going on. People willingly put themselves in categories, label themselves. And in that sense, their being it stands in a contracted state. They're not allowing themselves to expand as a being and encompass all sorts of qualities. They've labeled themselves something very specific. And where do you go from there?
That's true, because I think that's what we're taught. Well, I believe that some are taught as young people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
How,
I do know what you're saying. It's a condition.
And that's how we're forming.
It is a condition.
Because of
yeah.
the way they taught us in the 70s, well, the late 60s, 70s, you know what I mean. You know the era, and how things were, and then we are lucky enough to be born in the 60s, and I think that we were the first people to have a black and white TV set. You know, like we were the first generation to actually be able to enjoy what color TV was. So I don't know. I think I understand what you're saying, and. You think because you put a whole different spin on things that I would have never thought. Did I lose you?
No, I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay. Now you get to play some really scary movies, but I love that you got to play a holiday movie. Now, what was that like for you? Because you sounded like you really enjoyed it.
Yeah, like I expressed earlier, it was an opportunity to portray a character that did more than inhabit a space with aggression. He was there to assist another man who was going through a troubling time. And basically, to sum up the story in a nutshell, a young man robs a bank He's put into prison for 5 years. And the reason he robs the bank is because his mother's been diagnosed with, is terminally ill with cancer. And so she's not clearly not doing well. And so he realizes that she can't even afford the medication to at least give her some more time. And so he becomes very frustrated. And he's a seemingly good guy, you know, kind of church-going type man with a good heart and morality. And there's these flashback sequences where he remembers his mom and father having a conversation over the dinner table about stealing, if it's ever okay to steal something, you know. And so he's struggling with this model in his mind because he's faced with the temptation to do that very thing, to steal something, because, you know, the greater importance is that his mother survive and he get this medication, even if it means breaking the law. So he's definitely facing quite the moral dilemma, isn't he? And so he, you know,
yeah,
commits the crime, goes to prison, and meets me. And I play a character named Angel Sanchez, who is a former military guy who got into some trouble in the military and is placed in federal prison. And so we become friends and start speaking through the vents. You know, we share a prison, a wall in the prison. And long story short, you know, I'm more or less the voice of reason in the circumstance that helped to encourage him that he will, in fact, be granted a sympathetic release over the holiday and see his mom on Christmas Day before she passes away, because that's his, you know, his wish is to see her. And it's very, has aspects, the story has aspects of it clearly that I think people can relate to. Anyone who's lost a relative, a family member who got old or got sick and had, you know, had to face that tragedy or face that challenge would probably relate to how, you know, gut-wrenching that can be. So I think there's elements of the story that pull on the heartstrings and show what's possible even under the worst circumstances in terms of hope being present, even if it seems that all hope is lost. This movie definitely, I think, in its story shows the best that human beings can manifest as opposed to the worst. And it's been my experience as an actor who portrays characters that are tortured and placed in these kind of barbaric positions and doings. It's very nice for me to be on the other end of that pole now, to be helping someone rather than doing something nefarious or destructive. So in that sense, the character has insight, the character is sympathetic and caring, and lives in the frame of this Hallmark Christmas world. And so that's a very new wrinkle for me. And so I was very grateful to be able to participate in a movie like this that has a message that
awesome.
speaks to the heart.
Yeah. And now, would you do more films in that
just so you understand how this works, if I'm given the opportunity to do more, I will. You know, actors don't choose. It's like anything else in life. You don't tell the boss what to do, the boss tells you. So if I'm fortunate enough to be given an opportunity to portray characters like this in the future, I would love that. You know, we don't get to pick and choose. Maybe some people do, but the majority of the performers in Hollywood are not in a position to choose the jobs they get. They take what they get. Or they turn it down. Yeah, you're not in a position to tell the director. It functions very much like the workplace does in the more conventional structured workforce. The boss gives you the work order and tells you what to do. And, you know, if they feel that you're deemed worthy, you know, based on the politics or your ability, sometimes you're promoted. And sometimes people who, you know, are clearly capable don't get the job because of in-house politics. The movie industry is no different.
Yeah,
you can be great at something. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be afforded the opportunity to demonstrate that ability. If someone doesn't like you or you're not in the right circle, it's the same in show business in Hollywood.
That's really interesting.
You know, it's not what you know. It's not what you know. It's who you know. And I wouldn't broad stroke statement say that's the entire formula. You clearly have to be qualified. That helps.
Right.
But the variable of who you know and the connections you have is huge. You know, if Robert De Niro or Leonardo DiCaprio, or some of the great celebrities that have been afforded the opportunity to have masterful filmmakers like Scorsese, like Spielberg, like Stanley Kubrick, you know, I'm going to have a list of great filmmakers that allied with certain actors and basically created a platform for them by their genius, independent of that director. it's not to say the actor is any less than, you know, but the relationship to that genius, that director, who in of themselves had mastered something, puts you in a whole other light, because you're married now to genius. You're married to great filmmaking. You're not just a good or great actress or actor. You're now married to this thing that's bigger than you. You know, so there's that element of it too. There's that, I would call that the luck aspect. You know, I think most performers dream that they will meet, you know, their equal or greater, so that they can learn something and be promoted into a space of performing that, you know, becomes legendary, because then the art form is done, not the fame aspect, but the art form is done justice. You know, people are enamored by or moved by films and performances that shake the very foundation of the earth. You know, they scorch the earth with performance. You know, you're like, wow, that really touched me. That movie was fantastic. I'll never forget it. It lives in my memory forever. Well, there's a reason for that. You know? And I think anybody who, you know, has dedicated their lives to a career hopes that they have an opportunity to be in the presence of such great creators, you know, and auteurs, that, you know, so they can, you can hold hands and recognize the glory of that stature. You know.
What would you like to be doing in the next 5 years, Robert? What are some things, would you like to travel? What are some,
I've done a lot of traveling. I've been around the world. You know, I'm pretty much done traveling. Yeah, I travel all over Europe. I was in the Navy for 4 years. I've traveled all over the planet.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
man.
I've read
been everywhere.
That. Well, thank you for serving.
So,
I don't
know about travel as much, but specifically, I think that what makes sense is just to continue working and to be challenged by projects, you know, in a creative sense that keep me on my toes. So I'm definitely looking forward to those opportunities to fine tune and to continue to develop and grow as an artist and meet my equal and greater than, so I can learn something more.
That would be amazing. Because you're so talented. Has your any of your Navy experience helped you with some of your experience with filming?
Yeah, I did a film recently called Bridge of the Doomed. It's a zombie apocalypse type film, and the military called in to stall this invasion of zombies, and I play a general. So yeah, I would say my military experience definitely came in handy in that case and build that character. Yeah, sure.
Well, I want to thank you for serving the country and doing your part.
You're welcome.
My grandfather and brothers were in the Navy as well. So I don't know if it's a thing, but I do know that you men that put your time in, it's hard. And it's hard on everybody, the families and the person, you know, going in. But I want to thank you for that, because it's not an easy thing, what you probably had to do. And I'm just grateful that, you know, you're one of the men that we can be proud of for that, for definitely that.
I appreciate that, Deb. I appreciate you saying that.
We have to appreciate our veterans, or if it weren't for our veterans throughout history, we wouldn't be here today. And as free as we are, you know what I'm saying? So
that,
we should be grateful for our forefathers always. You know, they fought. They fought hard to get to where we're at.
I agree. Tremendous sacrifices they made.
Absolutely.
Tremendous.
Now, have you ever done a history piece? Have you ever done a period piece?
I think the only thing mythic that I've been introduced to me, and I've been allowed to participate, is in the underworld or overworld and supernatural of the vampire phenomena, like I mentioned, Bloodthirst. That's the only supernatural, superhero, underworld type mythology that I think that has ever really appeared. I think for a long time the tattoos have been a problem for people, because there wasn't a way to effectively cover them up with makeup like there is now. And so also the thinking back in the day was that tattooed people, you know, suffered some kind of social abnormality and were not to be taken serious. They were kind of like the rejects of society. So I think the thinking was that anything that even looked that way would not even be considered as a talent, because clearly it already consigned itself to stupidity by making those choices. Now, clearly the thinking has changed when so many people from all walks of life now demonstrating the art in the skin as being something to be adored and celebrated rather than to be, you know, labeled as, you know, the other thing. So there's opportunity now maybe for that. We'll see what happens, you know.
I love it. I think you should be like a superhero that's the, when you do like become the superhero, your tattoos glow and they change and you know what I mean? Like totally make something cool. You could totally do that. That would be fun. Now, if you could be if you could be in a DC comic or if you could be in, I don't know if you like them comics or not, but if you could be in any one of them and be a superhero, which one would you be and why?
I'm not going to lie and make up something I don't know because I don't really have a frame of reference for comic books. I don't read them. And I don't watch the comic book movies. I don't know anything about that. Let me think what speaks to fantasy that makes sense. I like the realm of the supernatural, this idea of the occult and the invisible world, and this notion of spiritual realms and what lives behind the veil, the physics of, you know, what we conceive reality to be, or perceive reality to be. So I wrote a story called Gabriel's Trial about a tattoo artist. It's a mystery thriller who is accused of a murder. And he has a close friend named Simon who's very concerned about his sanity because he's having these bizarre visions and seeing this woman appear before him, like this almost like this angelic type of apparition. And so I wrote this story in the hopes of getting it. I wrote it as a book and it will be published probably in January, but my hopes is to get it made into a film, and I believe it will be actually. So I live more in the realm of thriller and supernatural type stuff. You know, I wouldn't say I love horror, but I think it makes more sense to me, not so much the period stuff, but something that lends itself to the supernatural world and what we cannot see and how that influences the physics of our everyday life and how normal people can suddenly have a situation upon them and have to deal with it and require help from services or entities unseen. And so my story kind of deals with those elements.
That's pretty cool.
In a very real way, and deals with the character that you're not quite sure if Gabriel, because the name of the story is, or the movie or book is Gabriel's Trial. He's trials and tribulations, whether it's a trial on earth or a trial in the afterlife, you're not quite sure where this man stands in the balance.
That's
if
awesome.
He did commit the crime, if he's involved in this thing of witchcraft or people around him that, you know, speak of the peril of tattooing, and does it link you to satanic doings? And so there's all this kind of darkness, potential darkness that surrounds this character. You don't know if it's something that's coming from him or it's been built around him, kind of like the way Hollywood has built these characters around this idea of Robert Lissardo. Is it Robert or is it something they projected onto him, you know? So
that's cool.
I wanted to play with that game, you know, with that, you know, that dynamic, and kind of use the stereotype and turn it on its head a little bit so we can look deeper into what we consider the bad guy to be and why, and if he really is, you know, and if the people around him, are they good? What are they up to? So I wanted to, and wanted to also emphasize that love is also a necessary ingredient when we deal with these type of challenges in life and how important it is. So I use a female character in the story to convey that in a way that's not so conventional like you'd see in a Disney movie or, you know, the romantic comedy, but it does communicate a truth and why love is so important to heal even the worst of people.
I like that it's a book too. Stephen King does his that way. He does the books and then movies. So I love that you did the book because I think there are a lot of people that really do enjoy books still. And
I think they do too. Yeah. I mean, I think also with the book, you have more control. Once you introduce, you know, the movie variable, you not always have control in terms of how it gets made. There's other hands in it. The, you know, the people who finance the film, there's a political play that can somehow, you know, steer the film away from what was originally intended. With a book, you're completely in charge of how comes out. You're the, you know, the master and commander, so to speak. Yeah.
You're the master. That's right.
In command,
Robin,
you're
so
at the helm.
Cool.
You know,
when you get that book, let me know, or I'll keep an eye out, and I will share it with everybody.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I would love that, and especially
Thank
when
you,
it
Debbie.
Gets put into a film. And you never know who's listening tonight. It could be somebody that might be interested in picking that up and running with it, and that's what we can hope for. Robert, is there anything that you'd like us to know before we have to go?
Yeah, sure. Very simple. Anybody who's listening who likes Christmas movies and wants, a little bit of a holiday cheer and a tug on the heartstrings, check out Hope for the Holidays. It's available on Amazon Prime right now, and then will be available on Hulu and all the other, every other media platform, I believe, in December. Hulu, Google, YouTube, everything except Netflix, I believe. Yeah. So check
That's
out
awesome.
Hope for the Holidays, and then also keep an eye out for Bloodthirst. I believe will be released in the next year, early next year, 2021. Keep an eye out for Mind Games, starring Michael Paré and myself. That'll be released early in the year. Keep an eye out for Narcos Sub, action thriller, crime thriller, starring myself, Tom Sizemore, Lee Majors. That'll be released early next year as well. And also Bridge of the Doomed, the zombie movie I talked to you about. That'll be released next year as well.
That's awesome. I can't wait. I'm going to be watching those. All right.
Okay.
Robert,
thank you so much for
coming on. It's been a blast. You're a great guy. I hope you come on again maybe when you're done next year, getting all those films out.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Talk to me about that stuff. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on my show.
It's
and
been
I want to thank
awesome.
The audience for putting up with my blabbering. So hopefully
love
some
it.
Of it
love
makes
it.
Sense.
We love
yeah.
guests like you.
Okay.
Trust
All right,
me.
Cool.
All right. You have a great night, Robert. Thank you so
Take
much,
care.
Everybody,
Happy
for listening.
Okay.
Happy holidays
okay.
to you, too. Thank you so All much, right. everybody, for listening. That was Robert Lissardo, one of the greatest actors in Hollywood right now. And I want to say goodnight to you with Soul Food by Tebow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce
I play my backbone, jumping in the back of the zone. I keep it swinging like my man on the saxophone. With that new Jack mix for millennium, they ain't China with that new style you're killing on. I got an old school feel on a new groove. I make you feel beat the beat like a soul food. I keep you flying out to see like I'm Red Bull in the crowded room, baby, give me a room. This feels good like soul food.
The young ones say it's old school.
This feels good like soul food.
Like soul food,
but the young ones say it's old school. This feels good like soul food,
but the young ones.